enters your mind and write it down. When you write down your ants and talk back to them, you begin to take away their power and gain control over your moods. Here are some examples of ways to kill these ants. Ant: there's nothing to do. Species of ant: all or nothing. Kill the ant: there's probably lots of things to do if I think about it for a while. No one will ever want to date me. Always thinking: that's silly. Be patient and put myself in situations where I can meet people. The boss doesn't like me. Mind reading: I don't know that. Maybe she's just having a bad day. Bosses are people too. I'm stupid. Labeling: sometimes I do things that aren't too smart, but I'm not stupid. It's my wife's fault. Blaming: I need to look at my part of the problem and look for ways I can make the situation better. Your thoughts matter. Kill the ants and train your thoughts to be positive, and it will benefit your mind, mood, and body. Psychological: the work in four questions. Another technique that I teach all of my patients is called the work. It was developed by my friend Byron Katie and is explained so well in her book, Loving What Is. Katie, as her friends call her, describes her own experience suffering from suicidal depression. She was a young mother, businesswoman, and wife in the high desert of Southern California, who became severely depressed at the age of 33. For 10 years, she sank deeper and deeper into self-loathing, rage, and despair, with constant thoughts of suicide and paranoia. For the last 2 years, she was often unable to leave her bedroom or care for herself or her family. Then one morning in 1986, out of nowhere, Katie woke up in a state of amazement, transformed by the realization that when she believed her thoughts, she suffered. But when she questioned her thoughts, she didn't suffer. Katie's great insight is that it is not life or other people that make us feel depressed, angry, stressed, abandoned, or despairing. It is our own thoughts that make us feel that way. In other words, we can live in a hell of our own making, or we can live in a heaven of our own making. Katie developed a simple method of inquiry to help people question their thoughts. It consists of writing down any thoughts that are bothering us or any in which we are judging other people. Then we ask ourselves four questions and do what Katie calls a turnaround. The goal is not so much positive thinking as accurate thinking. The four questions are: 1. Is it true? Is the stressful or negative thought true? 2. Can I absolutely know that it's true? 3. How do I react when I believe that thought? 4. Who would I be without the thought? Or how would I feel if I didn't have the thought? The turnaround: after you answer the four questions, take the original thought and completely turn it around to its opposite and ask yourself whether the new version of the thought that is causing your suffering is not true or even truer than the original thought. In my office, I frequently find myself at my whiteboard writing these four questions and helping people talk back to the thoughts that make them suffer. Rosemary's husband of 34 years died of cancer. Rosemary was the alumni director at my college, and we have been friends for many years. After John's death, she was very sad and lonely, and I helped her work through her grief. 2 years after John died, Rosemary wanted to start dating again. She loved being in a close relationship, but she told me no one would ever want a 75-year-old woman. So we worked on that thought. Question number one. Is it true that no one would ever want a 75-year-old woman? Yes, she said. I am too old to date. Okay, question number two. Can you absolutely know that it is true that no one would ever want a 75-year-old woman? No, she said. Of course I can't know that for sure. Question number three. How do you feel when you have the thought no one would ever want a 75-year-old woman? I feel sad, hopeless, angry at God, and overwhelmed by my loneliness. Question number four. Who would you be or how would you feel if you didn't have that thought? No one would ever want a 75-year-old woman. Well, I would feel much happier, more optimistic. I would feel like my usual self, she said. Okay. Now turn the original thought around. No one would ever want a 75-year-old woman. What is the opposite? Someone will want a 75-year-old woman. Okay, which is truer? I don't know, she said. But if I act like no one will want me, then no one will want me. After our exercise, Rosemary started dating again. A year later, she met Jack. When I sat with Rosemary and Jack for the first time, it felt like I was with two 15-year-olds who had just fallen in love. It was so cool. They were married May 4th, 2007. All of us need a way to correct our thoughts. Just think about what would have happened to Rosemary if she didn't kill the ants that were stealing her happiness and robbing her joy. I have seen these four questions dramatically change people's lives, including my own. Byron Katie's own brain provides the most powerful evidence of this technique. As I said before, before she found the ability to question her mind, she suffered for many years. But the four questions gave her peace. Psychological. Gratitude and appreciation. When you bring your attention to the things you are grateful for in your life, your brain actually works better. Psychologist Noelle Nelson and I did a study on gratitude and appreciation. While she was working on a book called The Power of Appreciation, she underwent two SPECT scans. The first time, she was scanned after 30 minutes of meditating on all the things she was thankful for in her life. Her brain looked very healthy after the appreciation meditation. Then, she was scanned several days later after focusing on the major fears in her life. Noelle took the exercise very seriously and let flow a string of frightening thoughts. If my dog got sick, I couldn't go to work because I would have to stay home to care for him. If I didn't go to work, however, I would lose my job. If I lost my job, I wouldn't have enough money to take my dog to the vet, and he would likely die. If the dog died, I would feel so depressed, I still wouldn't be able to go back to work. Then I would lose my home and become homeless. Then I scanned her brain. Her frightened brain looked very different from her gratitude brain. She had seriously decreased activity in two parts of her brain. Her cerebellum was completely shut down. If you recall, the cerebellum is known to be involved in physical coordination, such as walking or playing sports. New research also suggests that the cerebellum is involved in processing speed. In other words, how quickly we can integrate new information. When the cerebellum is low in activity, people tend to be clumsier and less likely to think their ways out of problems. They think and process information more slowly, and they get confused more easily. When I saw Noelle's second scan, I thought, this is why negative thinking is involved in athletic slumps. If an athlete thinks he will fail, likely he will. I now had proof that negative thinking actually shuts down the coordination part of the brain. Noelle's fear meditation had also reduced activity in her temporal lobes, which are involved with mood, memory, and temper control. Problems in this part of the brain are associated with some forms of depression, but also dark thoughts, violence, and memory problems. Negative thought patterns change the brain in a negative way, but conversely, practicing gratitude literally helps you have a brain to be grateful for. Here is an exercise. Every day, write out 5 things for which you are grateful. The act of writing helps you solidify them in your brain. In my experience, when depressed patients do this exercise every day, they get better faster. Other researchers have found that people who express gratitude on a regular basis are healthier, more optimistic, make more progress toward their goals, have a greater sense of well-being, and are more helpful to others. Doctors who regularly practice gratitude are actually better at making correct diagnoses on their patients. Social limbic prescriptions. Social. Surround yourself with people who provide positive bonding. Have you ever picked up a container that had ants crawling on it? Within seconds, they've crawled onto your body, and you are hurriedly trying to brush them off. If you spend a lot of time with negative people, the same thing will happen. You may walk into a room in a buoyant mood, but before long, their ants are going to rub off on you. Their ants will hang out and mate with your ants. That's not what you want. So surround yourself with positive people as much as possible. Look at your life as it is now. What kind of people are you around? Do they believe in you and make you feel good about yourself? Or are they constantly putting you down and denigrating your ideas, hopes, and dreams? List the 10 people you spend the most time with. Make a note of how much they support you and the ways in which you would like to be supported more. In my second year of college, I got the bright idea that I wanted to go to medical school. I was on the speech team, and one day I told my speech coach about my dream to become a physician. The first thing out of her mouth was that she had a brother at Michigan State who hadn't made it into medical school. And, she added, he was much smarter than you are. The message was clear. You don't have a chance. Making a big decision like that was hard enough to do with encouragement. The disheartening comment from the coach was a blow to my confidence I did not need. I went home with my spirits considerably dampened. Later that evening, when I told my father what had happened, he just shook his head and said, "Listen, you can do whatever you put your mind to. And if I were you, I wouldn't spend much time with that coach." If you think of your life as an obstacle course, it's easy to understand that the fewer obstacles in the road, the better off you will be. Negative people present unnecessary obstacles for you to overcome because you have to push your will to succeed over their doubts, objections, and cynicism. Spending time with people who believe you'll never really amount to anything will dampen your enthusiasm for pursuing your goals and make it difficult to move through life in the direction you want to go. On the other hand, people who instill confidence in you with a can-do attitude and people whose spirits are uplifting will help breathe life into your plans and dreams. It cannot be overemphasized how contagious the attitudes of others are and how much hidden influence they can exert. The reason so many people feel good about attending a positive thinking seminar is that they have been in a room full of people who are all reaffirming the best in one another. But let one of these people go home and walk into a house where someone makes fun of his efforts and says he's wasting his time and will never get anywhere anyway, and watch how fast the positive effects of the seminar wear off. When you spend a lot of time with people, you bond with them in certain ways. As I mentioned earlier, the moods and thoughts of others directly affect your limbic system. If you go out with someone for dinner, and after the first half hour you're beginning to feel bad about yourself, and then you remember that you always feel bad about yourself when you have dinner with this person, you are not imagining it. Your limbic system is actually being affected by him or her. Deciding that you don't want to spend time with people who are going to have an adverse effect on you doesn't mean you have to blame them for the way they are. It simply means that you have the right to choose a better life for yourself. I believe that limbic bonding is one of the key principles behind the success of support groups like Alcoholics Anonymous. For years, clinicians have known that one of the best ways to help people with serious problems like alcoholism is to get them to connect with others who have the same problem. By seeing how others have learned from their experiences and gotten through tough times in positive ways, alcoholics can find the way out of their own plight. While gaining information about their disease is helpful, forming new relationships and connections with others may be the critical link in the chain of recovery. How our limbic system functions is essential to life itself. Choose to spend time with people who enhance the quality of your limbic system rather than those who cause it to become inflamed. Social. Protect your children with limbic bonding. In a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researcher Michael Resnick, Ph.D., and colleagues at the University of Minnesota reported that teenagers who felt loved and connected to their parents had a significantly lower incidence of teenage pregnancy, drug use, violence, and suicide. So important is the bonding between children and parents that it overrides other factors traditionally linked to problem behavior, such as living in a single-parent home or spending less time with a child. The article concluded that the degree of connection, limbic bonding, that teenagers feel with parents and teachers is the most important determinant of whether they will engage in risky sexual activity, substance abuse, violence, or suicidal behavior. Another study reported that, on average, parents spend less than 7 minutes a week talking with their children. It is not possible to limbically bond and have much of a relationship in such little time. Children need actual physical time with their parents. Think about the times your parents spent positive one-on-one time with you. Did that make you feel important, special? Some parents complain that their children are too busy or are not interested in spending time with them. When this happens, I recommend that parents force the issue with their kids, telling them that they are important to them and they need to spend time with them. Of course, the way in which you spend time with them is critical. If you spend the time lecturing or interrogating them, neither of you will find it very enjoyable, and both of you will look for ways to avoid contact in the future. Here is an exercise that I found extremely powerful in improving the quality of time you have with your child. The exercise is called special time. Special time works. It will improve the quality of your relationship with your child in a very short period of time. It also works for older children and teens. Here are the directions. 1. Spend 20 minutes a day with the child doing something that he or she would like to do. It is important to approach the child in a positive way and say something like, "I feel we have not had enough time together, and you're important to me. Let's spend some special time together every day. What would you like to do?" It's important to remember that the purpose of this time is to build the limbic bond and relationship with your child. Keep it as positive as possible. 2. During special time, there are to be no parental commands, no questions, and no directions. This is very important. This is a time to build the relationship, not discipline difficult behavior. If, for example, you are playing a game and the child starts to cheat, you can reframe her behavior. You can say something like, "I see you've changed the rules of the game, and I'll play by your rules." Remember, the goal of special time is to improve the relationship between you and your child, not to teach. Of course, at other times, if the child cheats, it's important to deal straightforwardly with it. 3. Notice as many positive behaviors as you can. Noticing the good is much more effective in shaping behavior than noticing the bad. 4. Do much more listening than talking. I once received a phone call from a friend of mine who complained that his 18-month-old daughter did not want anything to do with him when he came home from work. He told me he thought it must be one of those mother-daughter things, and that she'd probably grow out of it. I told him that it probably meant he wasn't spending enough time with his daughter, and that if he did special time with his daughter, she would become much more open and affectionate with him. My friend took my advice. He spent 20 minutes a day doing something that his daughter chose, usually playing with blocks in her room. He spent the time listening to her and feeding back what he heard her say. Within 3 weeks, his daughter's behavior dramatically changed. Whenever my friend would come home from work, his daughter would run to hug him, and she would hang on to his leg all evening. Remember, spending actual physical daily time with your child will have a powerfully positive effect on your relationship and protect your child from many of the potential problems in life. Social. Build people skills to enhance limbic bonds. It has been shown that enhancing emotional bonds between people will help heal the limbic system. In one large study in which patients were treated for major depression, the National Institutes of Health compared 3 approaches: antidepressant medication, cognitive therapy, similar to my ANT therapy, and interpersonal psychotherapy, enhancing relationship skills. Researchers were surprised to find out that each of the treatments was equally effective in treating depression. Many people in the medical community think that the benefits of medication far outweigh the benefits of therapy. Not surprising was the fact that combining all 3 treatments had an even more powerful effect. So not only were pharmaceuticals and professional therapists helpful, but patients played a significant role in helping each other. How you get along with other people can either help or hurt your limbic system. The better you get along with those around you, the better you will feel. I teach my patients the following 7 principles to help keep their relationships healthy and rewarding. 1. Take responsibility for keeping your important relationships strong. Don't be the type of person who blames other people for the problems in your life. It will take you down the rabbit hole of victimhood. Take responsibility for making your key relationships better and look for ways to improve them today. If you do this, your relationships will improve almost immediately. 2. Never take relationships for granted. They need to be constantly nurtured, like plants need water. 3. Protect your relationship. A surefire way to doom a relationship is to discount, belittle, or degrade other people. Protect your relationships by building those people up. 4. Clarify any hurts early. Whenever there is a question of motivation or intention, check with them about their behavior or motives. You cannot read other people's minds. 5. Notice what you like more than what you don't. It's very easy to notice what you do not like about a relationship. But when you spend more time noticing the positive aspects of a relationship, you're more likely to see an increase in positive behavior. 6. Maintain and protect trust. So many relationships fall apart after there has been a major violation of trust, such as an affair or other form of dishonesty. Once a violation has occurred, try to understand why it happened. 7. Deal with difficult issues. Whenever you give in to another person to avoid a fight, you give away a little of your power. If you do this over time, you give away a lot of power and begin to resent the relationship. Avoiding conflict in the short run often has devastating long-term effects. In a firm but kind way, stick up for what you think is right. It will help keep the relationship balanced. Biological social. Recognize the importance of physical contact. The limbic system is not only involved in emotional bonding, it is also involved in physical bonding. Touch is critical to life itself. In a barbaric 13th century experiment, the German Emperor Frederick II wanted to know what language and words children would speak if they were raised without hearing any words at all. He took a number of infants from their homes and put them with people who fed them but had strict instructions not to touch, cuddle, or talk to them. The babies never spoke a word. They all died before they could speak. Salimbene, a historian of the time, wrote of the experiment in 1248, "They could not live without petting." This powerful finding has been rediscovered over and over. In the early 1990s, thousands of Romanian infants were orphaned and warehoused without touch, sometimes years at a time. Pet studies, similar to speck studies, of a number of these deprived infants have shown marked overall decreased activity across the whole brain. Physical connection is also a critical element in the parent-infant bonding process. The caressing, kissing, sweet words, and eye contact from the baby's mother and father give it the pleasure, love, trust, and security it needs to develop healthy limbic pathways. From this, a bond or connectedness between the parents and the baby can begin to grow. Without love and affection, the baby does not develop appropriate limbic connectedness and thus never learns to trust or connect to others. The baby feels lonely and insecure and becomes irritable and unresponsive. Bonding is a two-way street. A naturally unresponsive baby may inadvertently receive less love from its parents. The mother and father, misreading their baby's naturally reserved behavior, may feel hurt or rejected, and therefore less encouraged to lavish care and affection on their child. A classic example of this problem is illustrated by autistic children. Psychiatrists used to label the mothers of autistic children cold. They believe the mother's lack of responsiveness caused the autism. In recent times, however, it has been shown in numerous research studies that autism is biological and precedes any relationship. The mothers of autistic children in their studies started out warm, but actually became more reserved when they did not get positive feedback from their children. The kind of love that is critical to making the parent-infant bond work is reciprocal. Love between adults is similar. For proper bonding to occur, couples need to hold and kiss each other, say sweet words, and make affectionate eye contact. It is not enough for one side to give and the other to passively receive. Physical manifestations of love need to be reciprocated, or the other partner feels hurt and rejected, which ultimately causes the bond to erode. Journalists George Howe Colt and Anne Hollister cite numerous incidents of the healing power of touch. Studies have shown massage to have positive effects on conditions from colic to hyperactivity to diabetes to migraines. In fact, every malady, Touch Research Institute in Miami, Florida, has studied so far. They report that massage, it seems, helps asthmatics breathe easier, boosts immune function in HIV-positive patients, improves autistic children's ability to concentrate, lowers anxiety in depressed adolescents, and reduces apprehension in burn victims about to undergo debridement. Even in the elderly, elders exhibited less depression, lower stress hormones, and less loneliness. They had fewer doctor visits, drank less coffee, and made more social phone calls. Healthy touch is essential to our humanity. Yet in our standoffish, litigious society, touch is becoming less and less frequent. Touch your children, your spouse, your loved ones regularly. Giving and receiving massages on a regular basis will enhance limbic health and limbic bonding. Spiritual limbic prescriptions. Spiritual. Passion and purpose. Having a sense of purpose in life may help you live longer, no matter what your age. Researchers evaluated data from over 6,000 participants, focusing on their self-reported purpose in life. E.g., some people wander aimlessly through life, but I am not one of them, and other psychological variables. Over a 14-year follow-up period, 569 participants died, about 9% of the sample. Those who had died had reported lower purpose in life and fewer positive relations than did survivors. Greater purpose in life consistently predicted lower mortality risk across the lifespan. Similar findings were concluded in a review of 10 studies of 137,142 subjects. Researchers found that those with a higher sense of purpose in life had a lower risk of dying from any disease, including cardiovascular events. Barbara Bush is a great example of this. In her early 50s, the former First Lady went through a period of depression when she felt like crying every day and had really dark thoughts. Like so many people, she was ashamed to seek help. She found that when she started to volunteer and direct her attention to help others, she started to feel much better. When she had a reason to get up and a purpose to her day, it had a healing effect. What is important to you? What do you deeply care about? What makes your brain sing? Answering these questions can help your mood. They can also help you live a longer, fuller life. Spiritual. Random acts of kindness. Can being kind to others make a meaningful difference in your level of happiness? Psychologist Sonia Leon Bomirsky from the University of California, Riverside, decided to put this question to the test with a controlled study that asked students to carry out 5 weekly random acts of kindness of their choice, anything from buying food for a homeless person to helping a younger sibling with schoolwork. The students reported higher levels of happiness than the control group, with students who performed all 5 kind acts in one day feeling the best by the end of the 6-week study period. Before this, other studies had found that altruistic people tend to be happy, but Dr. Leo Bromirsky established that good deeds are actually a direct cause of an increase in well-being and can decrease depressive symptoms. In another study, researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison discovered that human kindness is teachable and can change how the brain works in the process. Helen Wang and colleagues trained young adults to engage in a compassion meditation, an ancient Buddhist technique to increase feelings of empathy and compassion for people who are stressed and suffering. Participants focused on a time when someone else had suffered and then practiced praying that his or her suffering was relieved. They repeated phrases to help them focus on compassionate feelings, such as, "May you be free from suffering." The participants in the study first chose a person on whom it might be easiest to practice compassion, such as a family member or a friend. Then they practiced expanding compassionate feelings to a stranger and even to themselves. Finally, they were trained on how to extend these feelings to a difficult person in their lives. Dr. Wang is quoted, "It's kind of like weight training. Using this systematic approach, we found that people can actually build up their compassion muscle and respond to others' suffering with care and a desire to help." Brain imaging studies found that compassion training actually boosted the function in several areas of the brain, including the prefrontal cortex, which is involved with empathy. How many people can you show kindness to today? Chapter 8. Looking into anxiety and fear, the basal ganglia and more. Functions of the basal ganglia. Integrates feeling and movement. Shifts and steadies fine motor movements. Suppresses unwanted motor behaviors. Helps to set the body's anxiety level. Involved in forming habits. Modulates motivation and drive. Mediates pleasure, ecstasy. The basal ganglia are a set of large structures toward the center of the brain that surround the limbic system. They are involved with integrating feelings, thoughts, and movement, along with helping to shift and smooth motor behavior. Research suggests the basal ganglia are involved in forming habits. At Amen Clinics, we've noticed they are also involved in setting the body's anxiety level. In addition, the basal ganglia help to modulate motivation and are involved with feelings of pleasure and ecstasy, which is why drugs like cocaine and methamphetamines work in this part of the brain. Let's look at each of these functions in more depth. The integration of feelings, thoughts, and movement in the basal ganglia causes you to jump when you get excited, tremble when you're nervous, freeze when you're scared, or get tongue-tied when the boss is chewing you out. The basal ganglia allow for a smooth integration of emotions, thoughts, and physical movements, and when there is too much input, they tend to lock up. A patient of mine was badly burned in a motorcycle accident in San Francisco. As he lay burning on the ground, people stood nearby frozen with fear, unable to move to help him. For years, he was confounded by their actions, wondering why no one had moved to help him. Didn't they care? Was I not worth trying to help, he wondered. For years, this man lived with both the physical pain from the accident and the emotional pain of feeling that others did not care enough to help him. He was relieved to learn a new interpretation of the situation. The intensity of emotion caused by the fiery accident had overwhelmed the onlooker's basal ganglia, and they had become unable to move, even though most of them probably wanted to help. When the basal ganglia are overactive, as we have seen in the case of people with anxiety tendencies or disorders, people are more likely to be overwhelmed by stressful situations and have a tendency to freeze or become immobile in thoughts or actions. When their basal ganglia are underactive, as we have seen in people who have attention deficit disorder, ADD, often a stressful situation moves them to action. People with ADD are frequently the first ones on the scene of an accident, and they respond to stressful situations without fear. One day, my wife Tana and I were out for a walk when a pit bull came running toward us. I froze. Unsurprising, as my basal ganglia are always working overtime. But Tana rushed at the pit bull and scared him away. Tana has ADD. She's also a neurosurgical intensive care nurse who's very competent in crises. Don't ask her to remember to close cabinet doors or focus when she isn't interested, but she is the one you want in an emergency. To have her in my life, I'll happily close the cabinet doors behind her. Shifting and smoothing fine motor behavior is another function of the basal ganglia and is essential to handwriting and motor coordination. Again, let's use the example of ADD, which tends to show low activity in the basal ganglia as well as the prefrontal cortex and cerebellum. Many children and adults with ADD have very poor handwriting. The act of handwriting is difficult and often stressful for them. Their handwriting may be choppy or sloppy. In fact, many teens or adults with ADD print rather than write in cursive. They find printing easier because it is not a smooth, continuous motor movement, but rather a start and stop motor activity. Many people with ADD also complain that they have trouble getting their thoughts out of their head and onto paper. A term called finger agnosia, the fingers cannot tell what the brain is thinking. We know that the medications that help ADD, such as psychostimulants Ritalin, Dexedrine, and Adderall, work by enhancing the production of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the basal ganglia. These medications sometimes improve handwriting and enhance a person's ability to get his or her thoughts onto paper to an amazing extent. In addition, many people with ADD say that their overall motor coordination is improved by these medications. Another clue about the motor control functions of the basal ganglia comes from the understanding of two other illnesses: Parkinson's disease, PD, and Tourette syndrome, TS. PD is caused by a deficiency of dopamine within the basal ganglia system. It is characterized by a pill rolling, hand tremor, muscle rigidity, cogwheeling, jerky stop and start movements when trying to rotate a joint, loss of agility, loss of facial expression, and slow movements. Often, giving persons dopamine-enhancing drugs such as L-DOPA helps these symptoms by facilitating smoother motor movements. The basal ganglia are also involved in suppressing unwanted motor activity. When there are abnormalities in this part of the brain, people are more at risk for Tourette's syndrome, which is a combination of motor and vocal tics. More on TS later in the chapter. In our brain imaging work, we have seen that the basal ganglia are also involved in setting your anxiety level. Overactive basal ganglia are often associated with anxiety, tension, increased awareness, and heightened fear. Underactive basal ganglia can cause problems with motivation and energy. The basal ganglia have also been reported to be involved with learning, habit formation, and repetitive behaviors. In our research, one of the strongest statistical findings associated with increased activity in the basal ganglia is nail biting, which is usually a habitual expression of anxiety. With my overactive basal ganglia, it's no surprise that I used to bite my fingernails until my fingers bled. Interestingly, some of the most highly motivated individuals we've scanned, such as entrepreneurs and corporate CEOs, have significant increased activity in this part of the brain. We theorize that some people can use this increased activity in the form of motivation to become movers in society. My mother, for example, who like me has increased activity in this part of the brain, does tend to be a bit anxious. But she is a woman on the go. She raised 7 children without appearing stressed, and at the age of 84 plays golf several times a week and is always up doing something for other people. I believe that using the additional energy and drive from increased basal ganglia activity helps ward off anxiety. In our database, we have seen a strong association of excessive motivation with high basal ganglia activity. Another interesting finding about this part of the brain is that the basal ganglia are likely involved in the pleasure control loops of the brain. One brain imaging study performed by Nora Volkow's group at Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York, looked at where cocaine and Ritalin work in the brain. Both were taken up mostly by the basal ganglia. While cocaine is an addictive substance, Ritalin, in doses prescribed for ADD, typically is not. The study clearly showed why. Cocaine is a powerful enhancer of dopamine availability in the brain, and it has both very fast uptake and clearance from the brain. It comes on strong in a powerful wave, and then it's gone. The user gets a high, and when it's gone, he or she wants more. In contrast, while Ritalin also increases the availability of dopamine in the basal ganglia, its effects are less powerful, and it clears from the brain at a much slower rate. Dr. Volkow's group postulated that activation of the basal ganglia by cocaine perpetuates the compulsive desire for the drug. Ritalin, on the other hand, enhances motivation, focus, and follow-through, but does not give users a high or an intense desire to use more, unless at much higher doses than clinically prescribed. In fact, one of the biggest clinical problems I have with teenagers who have ADD is that they forget to take their medication. Intense romantic love can also have a cocaine-like effect on the brain, robustly releasing dopamine in the basal ganglia. Love has real physical effects. I had the opportunity to scan a close friend, Bill, shortly after he had met a new woman. He was head over heels for her. After their third date, when they spent the day at the beach in each other's arms, my friend came to my office to tell me about his newfound love. He was so happy, he almost seemed to have a drug high. By coincidence, while Bill was talking, my nuclear technician came into my office and told me we had an extra dose of the isotope and could do another scan if I had someone who needed one, since I had an earlier scan of Bill's brain as part of our normal control group. I decided we'd scan him again and get a look at the brain of new love. To my amazement, his brain looked like he had just taken a lot of cocaine. The activity in both the right and left basal ganglia was very intense, almost to the point of resembling seizure activity. Love has real effects on the brain that are as powerful as addictive drugs. Problems with the basal ganglia. Anxiety, nervousness, physical sensations of anxiety, tendency to predict the worst, conflict avoidance, Tourette syndrome, tics, muscle tension, soreness, tremors, fine motor problems, low or excessive motivation, sensitivity to rejection, social anxiety. Anxiety. Any discussion about anxiety must start with the good aspects of it. People with really low levels of anxiety are constantly late, often die early from preventable health-related problems, and are more likely to go to jail. As you can see, some anxiety is good. Appropriate levels of anxiety prevent you from driving too fast on a rainy night, get you to pay your taxes on time, and stop you from having an affair when you want to stay married. In one of the most important studies, in 1921, researchers from Stanford University evaluated 1,548 10-year-old children looking for the traits that were associated with health, success, and longevity. They then continued to follow them over the next 90 years. The results were fascinating. Longevity was not associated with happiness or a lack of worry. In fact, the don't worry, be happy people died the earliest from accidents and preventable illnesses because they tended to underestimate risks. The trait most associated with longevity was conscientiousness, which meant if you said you were going to do something and you actually consistently followed through, you lived longer than did others. Of course, balance is important. You want to have enough anxiety to do the right things, but not so much that it causes you to suffer. When researchers look at the brains of anxious subjects, they often find a number of areas of the brain with heightened activity, including the basal ganglia, amygdala and hippocampus in the medial areas of the temporal lobes, insular cortex between temporal lobes and prefrontal cortex, and areas of the prefrontal cortex, especially on the right side. Many of the patients we have treated with anxiety disorders have had heightened activity in these areas of the brain. Here's one of the first patients I scanned who had a severe struggle with lifelong anxiety. Gary. Gary went to his doctor complaining of back pain. The doctor examined Gary's back and found a tender spot over his kidneys. He asked Gary to get a kidney x-ray. As soon as the doctor asked him to get an x-ray, Gary's thoughts took off. The doctor's going to find out I have cancer. Notice this little leap in logic. But his thoughts didn't stop there. 10 seconds later, he'd already put himself into treatment. The doctor's going to find out I have cancer. I'm going to have chemotherapy. I'm going to vomit my guts out, lose all my hair, be in a tremendous amount of pain, and then I'm going to die. His mind took him down the rabbit hole of a futuristic hell all in a span of about 30 seconds. Then Gary had a panic attack. His heart began to race. His hands became cold. He started to hyperventilate, and he broke out in a sweat. He turned to the doctor and said, "I can't have that x-ray." Bewildered, the doctor replied, "What do you mean? You came to see me to get help. I need this x-ray so I can figure out." Gary said, "No, you don't understand. I can't have the x-ray." The doctor found my number and called me and said, "Daniel, please help me with this guy." As Gary told me the story, I knew that he had a lifelong panic disorder. Gary was an expert at predicting the worst, which was driving his panic symptoms. In treating Gary, I taught him the basal ganglia prescriptions given in the next chapter. I even went with him to have the kidney x-rays, because it was important to have it done quickly. I hypnotized him, enabling him to be calm through the procedure. He did wonderfully. He breathed in a relaxed way, and he went through the procedure without any problems, until the x-ray technician came back into the room with a worried look on his face and asked Gary which side of his back was giving him pain. Gary grabbed his chest and looked at me like, "You SOB, I knew you were lying to me about this. I'm going to die." I patted him on the leg and said, "Look, Gary, before you die, let me take a look at the x-ray." Psychiatrists are also medical doctors. As I looked at his x-ray, I could see that Gary had a big kidney stone, which can be terribly painful, but kidney stones usually don't kill anybody. Gary's basal ganglia, as well as the other areas described above, were working too hard, putting him through tremendous emotional pain by causing him to predict the worst possible outcome to situations. Anxious thoughts can make pain worse. As Gary became more upset about his pain, the anxiety signals caused his muscles to contract, the smooth muscles in the ureter, the tube from the kidneys to the bladder, contracted, clamping down on the stone and intensifying the pain. Over time, Gary's four circles interventions included biological, the anticonvulsant medication gabapentin, Neurontin to calm the anxiety. Today I would have started with the supplements magnesium, GABA, theanine, and Relora to help soothe the anxiety, omega-3 fatty acids, and diaphragmatic breathing exercises. Psychological, meditation, hypnosis, and ant therapy to question the automatic negative thoughts. Social, group therapy to enhance his social skills. Spiritual, an extended discussion to help Gary develop a clear sense of meaning and purpose. Anxiety-provoking situations also cause many people with overactive basal ganglia to become frozen with fear and unable to leave their homes, a condition called agoraphobia, fear of being in public. I have treated many people who have been housebound for years, one woman for 40 years, because of fear of having a panic attack. Marcia, a critical care nurse, was forced into treatment by her husband. She was 36 years old when she first began experiencing panic attacks. She was in a grocery store when all of a sudden she felt dizzy and short of breath, with a racing heart and a terrible sense of impending doom. She left her cart in the store and ran to her car, where she cried for over an hour. After her first episode, the panic attacks increased in frequency to the point where she stopped going out of her house, fearing that she'd have an attack and be unable to get help. She stopped working and made her husband take the children to and from school. She was opposed to any medication because in the past, her mother, in attempting to treat her own panic attacks, had become addicted to Valium and had often been quite mean to Marcia. Marcia did not want to see herself as being in any way like her mother. She believed that she should be able to control these attacks. Her husband, seeing her dysfunction only worsen, took her to see a family counselor. The counselor taught her relaxation exercises and how to talk back to her negative thoughts, but it didn't help. Her condition worsened, and her husband brought her to see me. Given her resistance to treatment, I decided to order a spec study to evaluate Marcia's brain so I could discuss it with her. Her spec study revealed marked increased focal activity in the right side of her basal ganglia. Interestingly, the findings on her scan convinced Marcia to try medication. Her four circles interventions included biological, gabapentin, Neurontin to quiet her basal ganglia, omega-3 fatty acids, and diaphragmatic breathing exercises. Psychological, hypnosis and ant therapy. Social, family therapy to help her family understand her illness. Spiritual, reconnecting with her sense of purpose, which had been very high as a mother, wife, and nurse. After 2 months of treatment, she was able to leave her house, go back to work, and resume her life. Several years later, she was able to completely stop her medication and has remained panic-free. Post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, occurs after experiencing a traumatic event that resets the brain to a perpetually more active state. Our published research on over 1,000 patients with PTSD demonstrates increased limbic, basal ganglia, and anterior cingulate gyrus activity in what looks like a diamond pattern. Common PTSD symptoms also associated with increased activity in these areas. Recurrent upsetting thoughts or dreams of a past traumatic event, such as molestation, being in an accident, or a fire. Panicked or fearful response to experiences that resemble that past event. Efforts to avoid thoughts or feelings associated with a past trauma. Feeling that your future is shortened. Being easily startled. Constant anxiety or fear of future bad events. In 2005, my colleagues and I evaluated and treated 6 police officers who had been involved in on-the-job shootings, developed PTSD, and were placed on medical leave. The diamond pattern was seen in all of their brain scans. After treatment with a special psychotherapeutic technique called EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing,